You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2000, the Tribune Company, owner of the Chicago Tribune, bought the Times Mirror Company, owner of the Los Angeles Times. 7 years later, when the combined company was put up for sale, Sam Zell, a real estate tycoon, took them over in a deal that spelled disaster for the future of both newspapers. In his new book, The Deal from Hell, James O'Shea, the former editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times, tells the inside story of how greed and Wall Street plundered the newspapers and hastened the collapse of some of our leading publications. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings James O'Shea to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Now, you've worked in the newspaper industry for four decades. Was this the book you imagined that you'd be writing about it?
No, I didn't. I actually thought that I would be writing a book about the difficulty of putting together these two companies. I thought I might write a novel one day about the newspaper business, but not this one.
But this one sounds like it grows out of either anger, outrage, or maybe you see it as a kind of obituary.
I wanted to basically put on the record what happened, and I felt like this was the best venue to do it. I didn't want to, I don't consider it a screed against anybody. I just wanted to say, okay, folks, this is what happened when these two companies got together, and here are the forces that really did do us in.
Well, did you worry that as an insider you might be too close to the subject to be completely objective about it?
I did. What I did is, as I wrote the book, I gave it to colleagues and friends and people who were in the business and people who were not in the business. And I asked them, I said, is this too much inside baseball? Am I too close to this? And when they said yes, I pulled back.
Almost all the reviews start off by saying that this is about the tail end of a once powerful and important industry. Do you see it that way?
I see it as a book about the decline of this industry and its struggle to find a future. I don't think it's we're writing the end of the story on newspapers. I think they will survive and prosper, maybe not prosper, but thrive. But they're going to have to convert into some new kinds of organizations.
Well, some people are suggesting that local newspapers, even the ones in major cities like the Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, will disappear or become just diminished versions of themselves with only a few remaining standing, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, perhaps USA Today.
I think, the challenges that are being faced really are in the major metro dailies outside of, not including the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But
Chicago
LA
Tribune represents the second largest city in America, Los Angeles
right.
Times, the third largest city. You would think that they would be doing very well. They have major markets.
They have major markets, but their advertising is the problem is advertising. It's really not the news. They aren't losing that many readers. What they're losing in the newspaper, they're picking up online. It's not that. It's the advertising. The business model for it is just going south.
Because classifieds went to Craigslist, and the internet has pretty much been a much tougher competition than anybody imagined.
Well, Google and the Googles of the world, their business model is based on big, huge audiences, and just a fraction of those audiences actually buy something. So they have to have these massive audiences, and so to get the massive audiences, they cut the ad rates, and the ad rates get so low that newspapers can't compete. And people really don't understand that, a newspaper's revenue, 80 to 90% comes from advertising, not circulation.
And this applies to all newspapers, the New York Times, the Post as well. The person who recruited you told you that in a job interview that Des Moines was a pretty swinging place. is the Des Moines Register still out there?
Yeah, the Des Moines Register's out there. It's owned by Gannett. I always tell that story because of the second part of that line when the guy told me it's a swinging place, but it's no Omaha.
Uh-huh.
And the Des Moines Register is a much diminished newspaper. It's owned by Gannett, which trimmed it down and cut it back. It's still there. It's still doing journalism. It has an online presence, but it's not the paper it was when I went there.
Well, papers of that sort felt that they had a special purpose. Often to talk about the things that the big newspapers wouldn't even know about, like what's going on in city government, seasoned reporter could just see a little eye contact between two people at a city council meeting and understand something was up. That's lost now.
I think that is the real danger of this, that the function of the press is this, the eyes and ears of the public is going away. And it's people say, oh, well, you know, anybody can be a journalist. I had a kid at Harvard say, all you have to do is hold up an iPhone and then put everything on the internet. But that's not what journalism is about. Journalism is about digging. It's knowing, as you say, that two people make a glance and you put a connection together and you know something's up because you've been there, you talk to people, you have sources, you dig, you go through records. That's what journalism is, and the average citizen isn't going to do that.
What was your first assignment in Des Moines?
My first assignment in Des Moines was to go talk to the parents of some chilled kids who'd been killed in a drive-in accident where they were sitting in the drive-in movie. The snow came up over their tailpipe, and they were all asphyxiated, and they sent me out to go my very first day to go to the parents and get their pictures and get out of the yearbook and get all the comments about them and make sure that everything was right. So I didn't expect that when I walked into a newsroom, my first assignment would be to interview the parents of a bunch of kids that were dead. But
that's a pretty tough assignment.
Well, I did it.
Yeah, usually they send you off to local club meetings, don't they?
Sometimes, yeah, but the Register was a very special place, and I obviously had backup. I had a seasoned editor on the desk. I had a guy helping me write the story. So.
And how'd they tell you to handle it?
Well, I went in and you know, he told me, go, here's what you have to do. A guy, Gene Raffensperger was his name. We called him Raff. And as I was sitting there looking at him, I think he could just see in my eyes that I had never done anything like this before. He said, have you ever done this? And I said, no. He said, come over here, sit down. And he sat me down at his desk. He said, you probably think that people are going to think this guy's got a lot of nerve coming in my house at a time like this. And he said, but you're wrong. He said, people want to talk about this, and you want to tell them that you're going to come here and you want to talk to them because you want to get this right, because you don't want something wrong about their kids in the paper. And he was absolutely right.
Hadn't you, before that, been a concessions vendor at Busch Stadium? How did you wind up becoming a reporter, and did that prepare you for becoming a reporter?
Well, it really did, because it taught you all of the being a selling peanuts and selling all these sorts of things in a ballpark. You had to become fairly aggressive. You had to learn that there were more than one ways to get things done. And I tell the story about trying to get through the green door where they were hiring, and I was getting beat up by all these guys, much bigger guys, and I went around the corner and banged on another door. And somebody opened it up and let me in and ended up giving me a job simply because I had a good story. So the whole experience taught me that there's more than one way to get through the green door, and there's always the power of a good story is overwhelming sometimes.
Was moving on to the Chicago Tribune a major step for you?
Oh, yes. At that time, I was in the Washington Bureau of the Des Moines Register, and that was a great job. And so it was kind of a lateral move, but I thought I wanted to go to a bigger paper. I wanted to be in a city where some of the big stories were.
But this was happening in the 80s, wasn't
right.
it? When you say there was a major change developing in the newspaper business. That's before the Internet started being a major competitor. What was happening then?
Well, that's when the companies all were going or were in the process of going public. And a new class of manager came in, and they weren't gone immediately, but you began seeing the seasoned editor, the old pro, who came up through the ranks of the newspaper industry, leaving, and professional managers with MBAs coming in, schooled in the art of taking a company public and getting it ready. It's ready for its stock to be sold to the public.
But by the 80s, we had seen in New York a major shrinking of all of our newspapers that wound up losing all of our afternoon newspapers. The Trib went, the Journal American, the Mirror, the World Telegram and Sun. So something was going on.
Yeah, well, that was a consolidation. They were, our lifestyles were changing. The afternoon newspaper started dying. They were the majority at the time of in the 70s, really. Most newspapers were afternoon newspapers. There weren't that many morning newspapers.
Here, the Post became a morning newspaper, even though it was an afternoon newspaper. Is this because of television, news?
It was television. The development of the suburbs made it much harder to get a paper out to your doorstep in the the afternoon because of traffic problems. There were just so many different social, this is the beginning of the time when women started entering the workforce, and so they didn't have as much time to read in the afternoon, and people began converting to morning papers.
But why did all of the families that own these newspapers start going public?
They started going public for one was to get the cash. They had stock in these companies, and they couldn't really get to convert that to cash. And secondly, the estate taxes became onerous, and they didn't want to pay these huge estate tax bills.
And also, as I understand it, the founder of the company passed it on to his children, but then. By the third generation, there was little interest in the newspaper business. People saw this as a chance to make some money.
Right. I mean, a lot of, I think one of the guys told me, old Joe passed it on, and he had some kids, and pretty soon the stock was held by 100 people instead of 10, and the 100 people wanted their money.
So who was Charlie Brumback, and how did his stewardship of the Chicago Trib change it fundamentally?
Charlie Brumback was a professional manager. He was an accountant. Went to work at the Orlando paper in Florida, which the Tribune owned, and he rose up through the ranks as a professional. He was kind of like a hired gun kind of guy. He came in and He wasn't a journalist. He was an accountant, and his main goal was to make the Tribune Company papers more profitable, more efficient.
So he wanted to soften the wall between business and editorial?
Well, he just thought that was a ridiculous wall in the first place, and thought he wasn't as dedicated to it as Mark Willis would later be at Los Angeles Times. But he just didn't see that as a reason. He didn't see any sense in that. He said, a manager, this is a business, and we have to run it like a business. And all this baloney about journalists not being managers, I reject that. You have to worry about making money just as much as about the journalism.
Do you buy his argument?
No, I don't. I think that journalists do today have to begin looking more at the business considerations. We were protected and coddled. We would say, okay, that's a business side problem, and the business side problem is what did us in. I think that if they would have had journalists giving them more input about some of the problems they were encountering on the business side, the problems wouldn't have been as severe. But journalists rejected doing that, too.
Well, businesses did have some clout. Remember, I think it was the L.A. Times before you were there. Or maybe San Diego, they wrote an expose of used car lots. And so all the used car companies stopped running ads in the newspaper, and they lost a lot of money.
Well, those things were always temporary. I had the same thing happen to me when I was the managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, and I had a bunch of real estate executives pull all their advertising, and they said, I said, well, what are you doing that for? They said, because they want to send you a message. I said, well, pick up the phone and call me. I'm pretty accessible. And, they needed you just as much as you needed them at that time, because we were one of the few ways that they could reach their market.
Profits at the Tribune went up after it went public. Was everybody happy?
People were pretty happy because the profits of the paper the paper was really profitable. It was earning 20 to 30% returns, and employees all got stock, and so the value of their stock went up. So they were happy about this, but it couldn't be at the expense of journalism. That was the problem.
My guest is James O'Shea, former managing editor at the Chicago Tribune and past editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times. He's written a book called The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. It's published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with James O'Shea, former managing editor of the Chicago Tribune and also the former editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times. He's written a book called The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers, published by Public Affairs. So you were both the Chicago Trib and the LA Times. Were they very different newspaper cultures?
Oh, yes. Very different. The Tribune, I think, was a little more entrepreneurial. It was used to operating with fewer resources, a little more agile, and kind of did a lot of more enterprise reporting. The Los Angeles Times viewed itself as the West Coast version of the New York Times. It was a national paper. It was kind of the voice of the West. And it viewed itself as a competitor to the New York Times, and kind of the Tribune, they thought it was in a different class.
And they were very proud of their Column One.
column on, sure.
And which was?
It was a well-reported, deeply reported, well-written story about some issue of the day, or it could be about some, just a feature story about something. But they were usually very well-written.
By the time they were bought by the Trib, had they already had their problems with Newsday?
Well, they did have their problems with, you know, the Times-Mirror Company. The L.A. Times was the big dog in the Times-Mirror Company, so all of the smaller papers resented the L.A. Times. And so then when the Tribune comes along, it's the littler paper buying the bigger paper. So the L.A. Times wants to be the big paper in the company, and the Chicago Tribune wants to be the big paper in the company, because that's the way it was before the merger. So that created a lot of tension. And Newsday had always been having problems with the L.A. Times, and unbeknownst to these people, Newsday was also having problems with its circulation and sales practices.
Which surprises everyone, because for a long time it was seen as a monopoly. It was always the thickest newspaper I remember seeing, because there were just so many Long Island-based ads.
Well, it was a great newspaper. The Newsday was probably the best tabloid newspaper in the United States. It was quality. It was a class act.
So did the L.A. Times destroy it?
No, I don't think the L.A. Times destroyed it, but I think the pressure began building and to keep its circulation up back into the 90s. And so they had to keep those – they wanted to keep the circulation rising. Now, somebody in the Tribune Company – Times Mirror should have begun saying, wait a minute here, what's going on? Almost every paper in the country has declining circulation except Newsday. Every year it goes up and up and up. But to keep, you know, it was actually a very expensive way, and not really a very economic way, to keep your advertising rates up, because the more circulation you have, the more you can charge for ads.
Now, the LA Times was owned by the Chandler family,
right,
which was one of the great newspaper families. Why did they want to sell?
They wanted to transform the company into something different. They felt that it was too newspaper-centric, and the Tribune Company at the time had a lot of television stations. It was an early advocate of the Internet. I remember back in the 90s, one of the things that Charlie Brumbeck, to his credit, did is he pushed us into the Internet, and we were one of the first papers that had an Internet site. So the Chandlers looked at their company and they said, we're too newspaper-centric. We have too much invested in newspapers. We need to diversify out, and so we merge with this new company, and it has television, Internet, and in the big markets.
And the argument was synergy.
Synergy, yes. Yes.
Which is the word that we were hearing a lot in those days.
We heard an awful lot of it, and I can tell you that it never worked.
Well, why wouldn't the merging of two great newspapers and all the resources that both of them bring not have worked?
Well, no one figured out that there would be a huge culture clash between the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, and between Chicago and between the West Coast. And secondly, the whole thing was predicated on selling national advertising. So, you know, you'd go to an advertiser and you'd say, well, we have papers in Chicago, we have papers in Los Angeles, and we have papers in New York, the three largest markets in the country. We can get you into these markets. The trouble is, people don't buy advertising that way, one. And secondly, they really didn't have a paper in New York. They had Newsday, which is out on Long Island.
And well, they had a newspaper in New York Newsday, but they closed that down.
That was Times Mirror closed that down. Right. Mark Willis closed that.
Now, but you would also think that since there's a lot of redundancy, they could have saved a lot of money. You don't need as two separate bureaus in Washington and in Paris and in London and everywhere else.
Well, we did eventually cut bureaus. We did save lots and lots of cost on the business side. The L.A. Times, there were hundreds of millions of dollars worth of costs were taken out of that company. But, you know, closing the bureaus was that was the autonomy of the paper. That was, so if you went into the Los Angeles Times and says, you know, we're going to just have one Washington bureau, well, who's going to run it? And there was a competitiveness there that you really didn't want to kill, because it produced good journalism.
There was also the problem of the Chandler family, wasn't there? Isn't it true that in the years before the merger, the heirs demanded and got very high dividend payments?
Just, they took a lot of money out of the LA Times, huge amounts of.
So did that hurt the paper?
I think it did. You know, at the time, they were generating big profits. Both the Tribune Company and the Times-Mirror Company were generating huge profits. Those profits were not reinvested in the company. They were usually passed along to either Wall Street or the Chandlers in the form of dividends, or buying the stock back to try to get the price back up. And that was money that could have been invested in the Internet, and it could have been invested in alternative forms of journalism. It could have been invested in other businesses that would have that weren't so vulnerable to cycles in the economy.
So they didn't own any TV stations?
The Chandlers did not own many. They owned a few. I think when Times-Mirror came along, Tribune owned a lot of TV stations. They bought a lot of television stations.
How was this merger affected? Was it done in secret?
It was done very secretly because they didn't want to initiate. They didn't want any other buyers coming into the market. So the Tribune really basically paid top dollar for the L.A. Times, the Times-Mirror Company.
And you were at the Trib at the time.
I was
were
at the
you
Trib.
Aware that this was happening?
Was I aware that the merger was underway?
Yeah.
No. I mean, we were kept hearing rumors, and we would be checking them out, and we kept hearing talk about this, but they were doing it very secretly. The whole merger was done behind closed doors.
Uh-huh. And in the end, it was the Chicago Trib taking over. Did the Chandlers keep their fingers in it at all?
Oh, yeah. They were a major stockholder in the surviving Tribune Company. And actually what it was is it was really almost a hostile takeover by the Tribune Company and the Chandlers against the minority shareholders of Times-Mirror.
Now, your subtitle is How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. What's Wall Street's role in all of this?
Has several roles. One,
should we be occupying Wall Street because of newspapers as well?
I don't know if I want to go down and occupy it because that would apply some ownership, and I don't know if I want to be there these days. It's a little too volatile for me. But anyway, the two things that Wall Street did is you know, like Times-Mirror was a diversified company for a while, and the Wall Street analysts kept saying, you know, you got to make this a media company. We want to be able to see it clearly. So they began selling off a lot of those assets, which were used to pay Chandler dividends, and so that it was that. And then in the Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, we were coming in with 20% and 30% returns, and Wall Street got used to that, and so they said, we want you to continue to 20% to 30% returns. So instead of taking that money and reinvesting it in the kinds of things that I think they should have invested in, a lot of it went to the bottom line to satisfy Wall Street to keep the stock price up, and the stock price, of course, bonuses and everything else were tied to that. And then the last part of it is when Sam Zell came along, and everybody saw the opportunity to make so much money on the loans that he would use to buy the company. I mean, the fees were approaching $300 million on that deal. I mean, I could have run the L.A. Times newsroom for more than 2 years with 900 and something plus journalists for the fees that they did on this deal alone.
He was a rich man. Did he need to borrow all that money?
Well, no, he didn't really need to, but that's the way he operated. I mean, I think in the long run, Sam probably he lost maybe a couple hundred million dollars in this thing. He said it was 315, but he passed some of that off to others.
Well, he bears some of the blame for that loss, but we'll get to that in a moment. My guest is James O'Shea. His book, The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC. WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At this point, you're still at the Chicago Tribune, and you were accused of pursuing projects just to win Pulitzers. Do you admit to that?
No. If we won Pulitzer Prizes, that was great. That's really terrific because it's a recognition of your staff and your paper and all the hard work you put in it. But I don't think I ever sat down and said, I'm going to do this to win a Pulitzer. Because, you know, if you do, you'll never win a Pulitzer.
On the other hand, if somebody comes to you with a great story, you have two choices: to put a lot of resources behind it or to say, well, you know, we don't have very much money these days. Let's see what you can give us.
Well, I always asked our reporters to come up with a plan. You know, it wasn't like I would sit there and say, oh, yeah, let's do this or not do that. I'd say, bring me a memo. Tell me why we should do this story. How will it benefit our readers? Where will we take this story that no other paper has taken it? So that it would be unique content so that a person reading the Chicago Tribune would get content that they couldn't get anywhere else. That was my real goal.
At what point were you offered the job as editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times?
That was in November of 2006. it was one of these strange situations where there was a lot of turmoil. The L.A. Times was really basically in revolt, open revolt against the Tribune Company.
Well, the editor, Dean Baquet, had made a rousing speech at the Associated Press Managing Editors Convention that year, and he was seen as something of a hero in the industry.
Well, he was, and what he was saying wasn't all that wrong. He was saying you should resist some of these cuts. I think it wasn't so much the cuts. It was, why are we keep cutting and not if we're going to cut staff, we should take the savings and reinvest it in the Internet or something like that, not just do it. That wasn't a strategy to just cut.
So
I think that was his complaint.
So when you were brought in, were you seen as representing the enemy?
Oh, yes. I had a friend tell me, no matter what you ever do in this newsroom, you'll always be seen as a hatchet man from Chicago. I'll never forget that.
So how do you work with that? I mean, first you tell people it's not true.
Well, I think...
And they don't believe you.
Well, you know, I'll never forget the first day I walked into the Globe lobby of the L.A. Times and a security guard was standing there. And I said I was there to see David Hiller, and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Jim O'Shea." And he said, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm the new editor of the paper." He said, "Oh yeah," and so he gives me a pass, and it was good for one day. And I thought that was pretty prophetic. Uh-huh. I walked into the newsroom, and there were pictures all around the newsroom of Dean Baquet and Otis Chandler, who was the patron saint of the L.A. Times, who had died earlier that year. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm up against a saint and a dead man. But I just decided that journalists were people who you could talk to. And that's what I did. I called a meeting. I got up on a desk, and I talked to the staff, and I said, I'm a reporter just like you. I think I can do some good, and I'm here to help.
Well, was your mandate to cut staff, or could you compensate by cutting expenses?
My mandate was basically to run the newsroom on an equal level to the Chicago Tribune newsroom on the financial metrics. And that didn't necessarily mean laying off people. I had to we were looking at the newsroom as a percentage of the revenue of the company. So if I could keep the percentage where I needed it to be, say 13% of revenue, if I could achieve that by cutting costs and by enhancing revenues, that was fine. Nobody really cared. They just wanted that. They wanted that you to come in at the percentage level that they thought.
Did you manage to win the staff over?
Eventually, I think I don't know if you would say I won the staff over. I think eventually the staff accepted me. They worked for me, and they did a good job. And a lot of them were sad to see me go.
And did you improve the profit structure of the newspaper?
I don't know. In the first year I was there, the L.A. Times was one of only six papers whose circulation rose, the daily paper. I lost a little on Sunday. I came in under budget. I delivered on my promises, yes.
So how did the company come up for sale?
Well, the Chandlers got into a spat with Dennis Fitzsimons, who was running the Tribune Company, and they got into a huge row about the future. How can you get the stock price up? That's what they were all trying to do. And when Dennis embarked on a plan that the Chandlers didn't like, the Chandlers sent out a letter that was bitterly critical of Fitzsimons and his management style and the company, and that, in effect, put the company up for sale.
So Sam Zell was seen as a savior at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Sam Zell was out there, and he came along, and there were very few bidders.
He had a reputation for having a kind of a Midas touch with his investments.
They called him the grave dancer because he would pick up all these companies for a dime on the dollar and then make a lot of money off of them.
But didn't the banks see this, all of the borrowing as a problem that would have to be addressed somewhere down the line?
You know, some of them did, but, you know, they were here. This was part of the whole subprime mortgage kind of technique, where they would make the loans and then they would sell them off to somebody, so they didn't have to worry about getting repaid. They'd just package them up and collect a big fee. So no, they knew that there was a problem with this much debt, and some of them even predicted that the company would go bankrupt with this much debt. But they were not counting on being around to have to collect it. They were counting on making the loan, selling it off to someone else, and getting a big fee.
So they got the big fees. You say that Zell was secretive. When you were at the Chicago Tribune, you wrote a piece about him in the magazine. Was that a warning to you?
Well, yes, it was. I mean, I didn't write the piece. Another reporter wrote the piece. I was the deputy managing editor at the time and had oversight of the magazine under me. But, yeah, we should have everybody, you know, it was a time when there was a lot of cutting and there was a lot of layoffs and everybody was looking for a way out. And here comes a guy along who had done – he had just sold his commercial real estate arm for billions of dollars. And everybody thought, well, maybe he's got the answer.
And so, then he came out and met the staff. What was the impression you got of him?
Oh, he was quite a character. Walked around. He never wore a tie. He was somewhat of a maverick. Cursed a lot. Talked. And he kept saying, he'd say to people, you know, cutting your way to the future. You can't cut your way to the future. And boy, was that magic to everybody. You know, everybody loved hearing that. And journalists, you know, we should have been much more cynical than we were. But we all wanted to hear this so bad that we went along and we embraced Sam.
He was upset that a columnist from the newspaper had gone out to his house in Malibu.
Steve Lopez, a great columnist for the L.A. Times, went out to do a story. He had been covering this controversy over converting public access to a beach in Malibu, and Zell's house was nearby. And so since he had just bought the paper, Steve went up and knocked on the door, and his housekeeper got upset, and Sam got real upset with me because of that.
How did he respond to a meeting with Warren Christopher and other Los Angeles citizens who were concerned about the future of the newspaper?
Well, he was pretty good about it until Warren Christopher was expressing some concern that the in its drive to economize that they would shut some foreign bureaus, and they thought foreign news was very important to a city like L.A. And Sam looked at him, the former Secretary of State, and said, "Warren, I don't give a blank what you think. All I really care about is what these guys think here." And it was everybody in the room, it was a room full of local luminaries from Los Angeles. Everybody was a bit stunned at the coarseness of the language.
And then you learned that he was polling people about how you ran the newsroom.
Yes. Well, that was David. That was his. That was not him. That was David Hiller, the publisher.
Uh-huh. He brought in this guy
who didn't
have much newspaper experience.
David Hiller was actually was the publisher of the Chicago Tribune before, so he had newspaper experience. But he was a lawyer and had come from that kind of background and didn't have much newspaper experience prior to his tenure at the Chicago Tribune. But even if you count the Chicago Tribune experience as a publisher, David was not a career newspaper guy. He didn't have a lot of experience.
So did this turn out to be a good deal for Zell and the stockholders and the Tribune staff?
No. Everybody lost. The company, I think a year after he took over, they filed for bankruptcy because the debt was so heavy and no one had factored in the severity of the financial crisis that came along.
So what's the current situation at the Chicago Trib and at the L.A. Times?
Well, they're
two great newspapers.
Yes, their staffs are greatly diminished. The size of the paper is diminished. They've killed sections. When I left the L.A. Times, there were 940 journalists in the newsroom. It's probably now somewhere between 500 and 550. The Chicago Tribune, when I was the managing editor there, there were a little over 600 journalists. I imagine they're down to 350. So there have been cuts. The size of the paper has been cut. The nature of the paper has changed.
The L.A. Times had, for example, a great book review. So did the Chicago Trib. They're gone.
They're both gone, right.
And other sections of that sort.
Other sections of that sort. They still do good journalism, and there's still a lot of good journalists working at the L.A. Times and the Chicago Tribune. But I think the great work tends to be more episodic and less systematic than it used to be. And I think the papers are in a kind of a death spiral.
After this book, do you think you can get another job at a newspaper?
Well, no. I'm actually running a nonprofit journalism operation in Chicago called the Chicago News Cooperative, trying to kind of figure out some of these problems. But no, I didn't. I kind of knew when I wrote that book that was probably the nail in the coffin for me.
James O'Shea's book, The Deal from Hell, How Moguls and Wall Street Plundered Great American Newspapers. It's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.